From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the early morning hours on June 28, 1969, in a part of Manhattan known as Greenwich Village. At the time, very few bars and restaurants were welcome to openly gay people. The Stonewall Inn was an exception. The police routinely raided bars in those days. They would turn the lights on, use various methods to identify whether the men were biologically male and the women were biologically female. But on that particular night at Stonewall, the patrons had kind of had enough of those raids. Eight officers were said to have arrived around 1:20 in the morning, and they announced they were, quote, taking the place. The music was turned off. The lights were turned on. Just over 200 patrons were there. Some began to run for the doors and windows, but police blocked them. This time, instead of following police orders to go to the bathrooms so officers could verify biological sex, the patrons largely resisted, and what happened next has become known as the Stonewall Riots or the Stonewall Rebellion. And for years, it was largely unknown outside the gay community. But President Obama has mentioned Stonewall in a number of national addresses. And in June, the president designated the Stonewall National Monument as the newest addition to America's national parks system. As the president explained, the Stonewall Monument is the first to tell the story of the struggle for LGBTQ rights. And now the Landmark Society of Western New York is planning to recognize local landmarks of significance in the history of Rochester's LGBTQ community. And they will recognize their importance both historically and culturally. So what are those local landmarks? What's the history that we should know here? What should we know about something like Stonewall? Let me go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. From the Landmark Society of Western New York, their Associate Director of Preservation is Larry Francer. Larry, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Also here is Evelyn Bailey. She's the chair of the Shoulders to Stand On program of the Gay Alliance of the Genesee Valley. Been volunteering for them, and she has been sort of a de facto historian in the LGBTQ community here for the better part of this century. It's nice to see you here, Evelyn. It's true.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you for being here. And John Cullen's here. John's got a mouthful of a title. I'm going to do it once. He is the assistant director of the Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester, and he's director of diversity and inclusion at the Clinical and Translational Science Institute at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
Our time's up.
Yes, it's been a good hour. We'll talk to you again. Thanks for being here as well, John.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Evan.
Let me just briefly start with you, John, because I want to dive a little bit more into Stonewall. But is it fair to say that until President Obama, we almost never heard Stonewall mentioned on the national stage by political leaders?
Probably not. He was one of the first politicians who really brought it to the forefront. It probably was really only known among the LGBTQ community as being sort of an iconic event that sort of sparked modern day gay rights.
Okay, so before we get into that, because I think this is a great moment for a history lesson that I am certainly keen on, because I've done my own reading for this program, and there are certain things that I read and I say, is that really true? And John and I were talking before the program, and I think it will surprise you in the way it has surprised me. But before we do that, Larry Francer, the Landmark Society has decided to focus on Rochester and Western New York's cultural significance, these landmarks, these monuments here. Why this? Why now?
Why this? Why now? Well, it really started when I came here about 4 years ago. Okay. Wayne Goodman, our executive director, and Jason Roberts, who's now with Trillium mm-hmm. and is on our board as well, got together just to see how the Landmark Society could be more involved in the gay community. I mean, historically, the LGBT community has been very involved in preservation and taking neighborhoods that are run down and moving in and really bringing them back to life. And that's something that we wanted to really celebrate. And at the same time, it was really when Stonewall was being looked at as a local landmark in New York City. So we've been talking about it for years, and it was really a grant through the LGBTQ Giving Circle at the Community Foundation, which started it off. We've been talking about it. We really wanted to move ahead because at this time where we are so involved in community, where there is marriage equality, where we could just sort of maybe blend in very easily, we were concerned that this important history of our our landmarks, are the places that really mean a lot to the LGBTQ community could just be lost if we didn't really get a good survey done and get those sites listed.
And so now, thanks in large part to Evelyn, and we're going to talk about this list here.
Yeah.
But you also have something coming up on August 16th. And let's see, today's the... That's 2 weeks from today, yeah?
Right.
All right, so 2 weeks from today, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Landmark Society headquarters, that's on South Fitzhugh Street. What's coming up, Larry?
We're having a meeting where we just want to invite the community, let them know about this new initiative, and get some feedback from them. It's going to be, you know, a little bit of networking, a little bit of, you know, seeing our space as well, the beautiful Hoyt Potter House, and getting feedback from not just the LGBTQ community, but the community in general, mm-hmm. our allies, people who are just interested in this project, who may want to become a part of it, join us in it, and it's just going to be a really pleasant evening.
When I was talking about this last night with a friend, that friend asked, is there a Rochester Stonewall? I don't know if there's anything that stands out quite to that level, Evelyn, but is there one? We'll go down this list later in the hour. But is there one that stands out immediately? If you said you had to choose one, that's it.
Well, if you talk to men and women who have been in the community for a long time, what they remember most is Jim's Bar down on North Street. Hmm. That was the community-identified gathering place, although it was raided. And it was, police came in, the jukebox stopped playing. When they left, the jukebox would start playing again. But that seems to be the first place that people see as a place for organizing the community. Mm-hmm. And that's where the organization of the community first began, in bars, because we had no other locations to gather. And it was against the law for LGBT men and women to be gathered in a place for any kind of political activity or social organizing. Fine to go to a bar and have a drink, and not okay to dance, and certainly not okay to be seen holding hands or touching someone of the same sex. That was not acceptable.
And when you mentioned illegal, it was raided by police, and Rochester police would raid it in the same way that we're about to talk with John about the way New York City was happening, those kind of raids?
It was much more pleasant here in Rochester.
Okay. To the extent that a police raid could be. Yeah. That's quite a euphemism, but yeah.
The police would come in, and an officer would approach the bar, and the bartender would open the drawer and take out a stack of bills and hand it over to the police officer, and then they would leave. So, and in many ways, even though mafia was strongly involved in New York City, they weren't as heavily involved here. So, greasing the palm helped quite a bit.
Did the mafia own the Stonewall Inn, John?
Yeah, that's one of the things that they say, that it was owned by mafia affiliates. And similarly to what Evelyn just said, they were paying off the police when they would come and raid. What was unusual about the night that Stonewall Uprising took place was that it was a Saturday night and the bar was pretty much packed. Usually they would raid during the week when there would be fewer clientele present. So they think that may also have contributed to the reaction of the patrons of the bar.
Okay, so again, now let's go. We're going back to 1969 in New York. And you just touched on a few of the questions I had for the, is this true or is this not true? One of the things I'd read was that the basic framework was, yeah, that the raids would happen earlier in the night when it was less crowded, mm-hmm. or in the midweek, maybe not weekend, and that often someone at the bar would get a tip that police were going to be there. I don't know exactly why that was, then, other than that Evelyn just sort of identified. Maybe they're ready with a gift for police, yep. when they show up, yes?
Yeah, that's a possibility. I mean, they talk, I think, with history, the bar owner of Stonewall, I think, paid the police about $1,200 a month, sort of under the table to have them not arrest people.
So, okay, so, So that was one of the reasons that you may get a tip off. But police would show up, and were some people arrested simply for the way they presented themselves? I mean, in other words, I'd read that you had to wear so many articles of clothing. Is that true?
Yeah. And what was significant about the Stonewall Bar is that many individuals who wouldn't have been welcome in other bars that served gay population, people who would now fall under the transgender and gender nonconforming category, they were welcome at Stonewall. And New York State Penal Law in 1969 stated that a person must have three articles of clothing that correspond to their sex assigned at birth. So obviously, if someone was transgender or gender nonconforming, or even drag queens back then, they would be arrested if they didn't have clothing that matched their sex assigned at birth.
Three pieces of clothing? I mean, what a strangely arbitrary number.
Yeah, and that didn't include socks.
Socks didn't count.
Socks didn't count.
Okay, so they specifically said your socks can't count. I don't even know. Okay, I didn't want to. Okay, so three pieces of clothing. This really was happening. And then you could be arrested and jailed or fined?
You could be arrested, jailed, and fined. And what would happen as well was that people's names would be published in newspapers, rather high-profile newspapers, even with their home address, and they could end up losing their job because there was no protection based on sexual orientation. Back in 1969, it was illegal. Homosexuality was illegal in all states apart from Illinois, and it was considered a sociopathic personality disorder by the American Psychiatric Association. And even people who were in federal government, Eisenhower signed an executive order in 1953 saying that anyone who was sexually perverse, i.e. at the time that's how they defined being gay, could not be a government employee and would lose their job.
This is our country.
Yeah, I love it here.
Well, you know.
Well, look how much it's changed.
Yes, that's sort of the point, because you know we have a number of millennial listeners, and I'm not at all lecturing, and I'm not talking down to anybody. Only to say, if you've grown up post Stonewall, or you know, if you're in your 20s or 30s, it's just hard to even imagine. This is our country, so it's 1969. That's usually how it happens. But on this particular night at Stonewall, as John said, it was different. This time, there are conflicting reports about whether there was a tip-off phone call at all, but a lot of the people who were at the Stonewall Inn that night apparently did not know that police were coming. They showed up at 1:20 in the morning, much later than normal. More than 200 patrons were there,
yep,
and they just did not want to deal with it sounds like. But what kind of happened? Take us through that.
They did start arresting people and taking them out into the police wagon. And there are various conflicting stories. I don't think we're going to really get a true story. But it said that some of the transgender individuals who were there sort of shouted, enough is enough. And the crowd started to throw pennies at the police. Then they started to throw nickels and quarters. And eventually bottles were thrown. And there were 8 police officers remaining and some of the patrons that they had arrested. And they retreated back inside the inn for about 45 minutes before riot police arrived. And by this stage, approximately 2,000 people had gathered outside. And it was a cat and mouse game between the LGBTQ community and the police. And really, I mean, they did get the police officers out of the bar safely. Some of them suffered some injuries. But this sort of news of this spread very quickly. And the following night, more people assembled. And this went on for 5 nights. And what's interesting about the people who we're talking about here, who were, you know, activists, many of them, although closeted LGBTQ individuals, had spent a lot of time advocating for civil rights movement, for women's rights, and anti-Vietnam War protests. So I think they saw this as their opportunity to take on the police and fight for what they deserved.
So for about 5 nights, there was large crowds and sort of demonstrations. Did the police push back at that time?
Yeah, I mean, there was police pushback, but they never completely got them pushed back, and they never won. The LGBTQ community was also joined by other groups. So there were members of the Black Panther organization who came, mm-hmm, realized that this discrimination was unfair, and this sort of ignited the civil rights movement. And at the end of the 5 nights, the activists began distributing leaflets that said, "Do you think homosexuals are revolting? You bet your sweet backside we are." So this sort of was their sort of call to action for the group, and that's what led to the formation of the Gay Liberation Front, which was, and back then when they used the term gay, it kind of was all-encompassing, gay, lesbian, transgender, so all different people. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how this sort of movement started.
And at the end of that week, we had equal rights, and things have been just the same. It's amazing.
Just like that.
I think it would be helpful for you to know that part of the reason why the raid took place, mm-hmm. it was an election year. And the mayor of New York City was running for re-election, and one of his platform planks was he would clean up the city and he would make the city safe from a population that was not really accepted. And the raids increased over that year, and the Stonewall Inn stands out simply because they refused to go along and be herded into the police wagons. They would be taken in, they'd walk out. One person was put in a police car, they opened the door and walked out and would not allow themselves to be contained. So, and the marches at that time, Stonewall Inn is on a triangle in New York City. The police would come at the, and that night it happened. They came and they pushed the crowd back around the corner. And what the crowd did was they turned around and came around behind them. And then the police had to turn around and push the crowd back again until more and more police were called and people began to leave.
Well, and obviously it was just the opposite, of what I said. I mean, you get 5 nights of this, the first time really standing up to these police raids that had become common at the time. And of course, it took decades for anything approaching more of equal rights. I mean, it's still a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But that's why our LGBTQ friends and neighbors and brothers and sisters across this country, they may know Stonewall in the way that a lot of us who grew up without understanding the term, that's what it's about. And how, John, is it possible to overstate it? I mean, it really is an important place, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think what highlights its importance as well is the fact that our pride parades are named after that. So on the 28th of June, 1970, the Gay Liberation Front organized the Christopher Street Gay Liberation March, which eventually became pride parades. And I don't know when they changed the name to Pride Parades, but currently in countries like Germany, for example, in Berlin, it's not called the Pride Parade, it's called the Christopher Street Parade. So this kind of has had an impact right around the world, further than, you know, we know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now we've got a chance in Rochester to identify the cultural significance of locations around our area that stand out. And so, Larry, just let's go back to what's coming up here. On August 16th, that's 2 weeks from tonight, 5:30 to 7 at the Landmark Society headquarters, you're going to have a community meeting. But some will say, well, look, Evelyn's got you this great list. You've got a list already.
Evelyn says to me every time we talk, there are so many more that can be on this list.
There are.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that was 1969 we were just talking about. In 1970, on the list, Todd Union, University of Rochester campus, October 3rd, 1970, was the first meeting of the Gay Liberation Front here in Rochester. And I'm fairly new to Rochester. I've only been here about 4 years. Mm-hmm. But my understanding of the LGBTQ community here is that it's not only the bars that have been here for years. It's not just that it's a strong community, but really within the movement for gay rights and the liberation. I mean, that started way back in 1970, and that's very important on this list. How we'll end up using the list, and there are sort of different categories. On the list, we've also got Strong Memorial Hospital, which was one of the first aid centers that was identified by the NIH. I mean, that's really important, but that's not all there is to say about Strong Hospital.
Sure. And so ultimately, Larry, what can the Landmark Society do in terms of recognition practically once you make more progress in not only creating this list, being aware of these locations and their history? What can you do?
Well, there's a new program that the National Park Service has started recently, which is a grant for underrepresented communities. And they have given grants to a group in Greenwich Village to deal with the LGBTQ sites there. And what it's really working toward is listing on the National Register of Historic Places. So if you can get this listing, if we can end up getting this grant, if we can work toward getting some of these locations on the National Register of Historic Places, it not only brings them the recognition, but it may also allow them to get the federal tax credits, the historic tax credits, and work toward rejuvenating neighborhoods or spurring economic development, because the Landmark Society is really involved in economic development now. That's one of our, you know, big mission items. So the history is wonderful. We may be able to do a map. I was just saying we have this wonderful program you're aware of, our Where the Bleep Am I coaster program, which the YUPS, the Young Urban Preservationists, are working on. It would be great to have a section for gay bars past and present. You know, we've already got Abilene on there, and most of the little factoids are about Tara's, when it was Tara's. So that may be a way that we can get the word out. But we really want just to get the word out to the community at large, the importance of the LGBTQ community in sites and history.
Well, in our second half hour, I'm going to walk through more of this list, and I am very eager to hear from Evelyn some of the historical significance on this list. I'm totally ignorant on this history. I think it's so valuable. But I did want to ask John Cullen now, are we in a position now where, are we likely to see Stonewall end up in more actual textbooks? Are we going to see more American students growing up seeing it at least mentioned and taught in class now?
I think we are, given the significance of President Obama using it in his speech and, you know, comparing it to Selma and other civil rights monuments in history. So, and there's more of an acceptance now of the LGBT community across the nation. I'm not saying they're totally accepted, but we're getting there. And I think people are going to understand the importance of teaching this and sharing it with younger generations. And I think it's important for us as well with, you know, our youth that really attend the Pride Parade but maybe don't know the significance of it. And so we aren't sharing our history with them like we should be.
I think that's well said. Let's get our only break of the hour, and I will appeal especially to if we have LGBTQ listeners today, you know, how do you feel about the way our history, and I don't want to say your history, it's our history. How is it taught? How is it recognized? How is it appreciated? And do you see that improving? I mean, obviously the Landmark Society is aiming to improve the visibility, the recognition, tying that into our history, our understanding, and yes, economic development, all of those things tying together. But how do you feel about the fact that a lot of us have never really been taught Stonewall and maybe didn't until this president understand what that meant? I'd love to hear from you. You can call the program. It's toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. You can email the program. You can email me directly, edawson@wxxi.org. And maybe you can't get there 2 weeks from tonight. You can tell Larry Francer and Evelyn and the whole group here what you think should be on that list for Rochester. So let's get our break and have more of this conversation next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, previewing the Puerto Rican Festival. That's coming up. We'll talk about the events that are coming, the family-friendly activities. We'll also talk about planning for the aftermath and the way the festival organizers are working with the Rochester Police Department. We'll also talk about politics. Do you talk politics with your friends and family, particularly if people disagree, navigating those conversations Wednesday? Welcome back to Connections. I want Evelyn to start at a point she was making during our break, because it's the shortest break in radio, and I had to cut Evelyn off. But you were making an important point, I think, about even geographically in this country and the way we understand history and culture and the significance there. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of history has also happened on the West Coast in terms of gay rights. In San Francisco, with Harvey Milk, and I believe there's a U.S. Frigate, I think that's the correct name for the boat, that's going to be named the Harvey Milk. But in 1969, we didn't have computers. We didn't have cell phones. So whatever happened on the West Coast took time to reach the East Coast, and vice versa. Now, the incredible thing about Stonewall was, once that happened, within 2 years, there were 400 Gay Liberation Front organizations that sprang up all around the country, primarily on college campuses, but in local communities as well. And that's with newspapers and party lines and whatever else people used, letters, to inform their friends and spread the word. The sodomy laws weren't repealed until later in New York. You had oppression in housing, in employment, in social services, across the board, in healthcare. And so this epic event, which we identify as our quote-unquote beginnings, happened at Stonewall, but then it replicated itself all across the country. Here in Rochester, within 1 year, Stonewall occurred in June of 1969. In October of 1970, the Gay Liberation Front began at the University of Rochester. That's about 1 year and maybe 2 months. That's not a long time, given how communication occurred.
Can you imagine
then,
had there been Twitter in 1969 and 70, Evelyn? It would have been, I think you're right, though. I mean, just the speed of information.
There would have been a revolution around the country, and people would not have stood still. They would have taken to the streets, and they would have marched, and they would have protested.
I just want to verify some of what Evelyn said here. Megan Mack, producer, sends this along from USNI News. That's the U.S. Naval Institute. And I'll just quote from that. The Navy is set to name a ship after the gay rights icon and San Francisco politician Harvey Milk. The July 14th notification that was signed by Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus indicated that he intended to name a planned military sealift command fleet oiler the USNS Harvey Milk. Milk came from a Navy family and commissioned in the service in 1951. He served as a diving officer in San Diego during the Korean War on the submarine rescue ship Kitawaki until 1955, and he was honorably discharged from the service as lieutenant junior grade. So, and just going on to say, following his service, Milk was elected, of course, to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, was the first openly gay California politician to be elected to office. He was killed in office in 1978. When he was shot, he was wearing his U.S. Navy diver's belt buckle. So the USNS Harvey Milk. And wow. So that's just great. You know, to you, Evelyn, what's the significance of that moment?
Well, when I look back in history, Eisenhower era and before, the Lavender Scare created tremendous pain in military men and women and government officials who were forced, literally hunted down. Witch hunts went on to get them out of their positions of employment and out of the service. I've known military gay men who have stayed in the service, and they live more than a double life. because they cannot be out on a ship. I've known a couple of sailors. And when you're out at sea for 6 months, 8 months, it's really pretty difficult if you don't have other supports around you to maintain your own belief in yourself and your own pride. So I'm very glad this has happened. It's another, I would say, volcano that has erupted to bring awareness to LGBTQ men and women.
Let me turn to John Cullen, the Assistant Director of the Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester. He's also Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the Clinical and Translational Science Institute at URMC. John, it is one thing to see the president designate a landmark to be more inclusive in the way he talks about Selma and also Stonewall, those kind of things. It's another, as Evelyn says, to see the history of what we've done to gay people in the military and just the disposition toward LGBTQ men and women, brothers and sisters in the military.
Yeah.
And then to see the Navy take this step and name a vessel after Harvey Milk, that, to me, it feels quite extraordinary.
It's pretty significant, but if we take a step back and look at the military and how far it has come over the years, you know, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so people wouldn't be discharged. Also, more recently, allowing transgender individuals to openly serve in the military. And what's interesting about that is our military has a higher percentage of transgender individuals in the general population, because a lot of them who are struggling with their gender identity, especially those who are male to female, will go into the military to try and sort of reaffirm their masculinity. So allowing them to openly serve is something I don't think people would have envisioned 5 years ago.
Harvey Milk once said, "If a bullet should ever enter my brain, let that bullet destroy every closet door." Remarkable. So let's turn back now as we continue our discussion to Rochester and Western New York. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the Landmark Society's work to recognize LGBTQ landmarks of significance here in our area. They've got a meeting 2 weeks from tonight at their headquarters to kind of pull more people from our community, LGBTQ and otherwise, together to talk about these possible landmarks. Because as Larry Francer has explained, they want to not only uphold and honor the history and culture, but make sure it's preserved for many reasons, for history's sake, for culture's sake, even for economic development's sake. And we've been talking to Larry from the Landmark Society. He's here. Evelyn Bailey volunteers with the Gay Alliance of the Genesee Valley. She's the chair of the Shoulders to Stand On program. And John Cullen's here from URMC, University of Rochester, Susan B. Anthony Center, and a bunch of other things. I kept saying I was only going to read your title once, John.
Yeah.
So that's our panel today. So before we go ahead and keep going down that list of Rochester landmarks, let me get Ryan in Rochester, who's on the phone. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yes, I'm actually a professor that studies, you know, gay history and LGBT history, and I wanted to make a comment about how, while this is a really wonderful program and I fully support the idea of looking at landmarks post-Stonewall, we also need to think about the landmarks pre-Stonewall. In particular, thinking about, you know, the interventions of different historians like George Chauncey writing on New York City, who talk about a very vibrant LGBTQ culture that existed at the turn of the century, 1900, well before Stonewall, that was largely forgotten because of the repression that happened in the 1940s and 50s. So I wanted to encourage the Landmark Society to think about what those sites might actually be in Rochester and the area prior to Stonewall. Thank you.
Ryan, thank you for the phone call.
Yeah, that's great. Absolutely. You're on it, Evelyn.
Well, if you go back before Stonewall, you go to French Street. And French Street is no longer because of urban renewal, but a part of it still exists. And on French Street, that's where what people identified as the Bowery of New York City, that's where our Bowery was. During the day, women and men would go there to buy clothing, they would shop. There were all kinds of purveyors. And at night, you would have Dick's 43, a bar that was open to gay men and women. You had Ma Martin's, which was a restaurant that was frequented by LGBT men and women. that was the place that the, I don't want to, more mature LGBT community would have gone, but it was a very seedy place. If, I mean, many of the areas pre-1960 were not pretty to look at. And you had the wharfs not very far from Front Street, and the boats would come in. So you had a variety of men and women and diverse men and women coming into the city at that time. Unfortunately, Dick's 43 moved and was burned at its new location. And I can't remember exactly where that was. Mar Martin's is no longer. The Reynolds Arcade, which was right on Front Street, a part of the Mercantile District, isn't there any longer. So I'm hoping that there will be some sort of recognition of Front Street as a precursor to Stonewall in this community. I also would like to very briefly mention Rochester has a legacy of liberation that goes back hundreds of years to Susan B. Anthony, to Frederick Douglass. And unfortunately, that legacy of liberation just doesn't sink into the heterosexual community. It also sinks into the LGBT community and other minority communities and other disenfranchised communities. And so to think that liberation is segmented in particular groups is a misnomer. I think the historical, the Landmark Society, in trying to bring visibility to LGBT places and locations is really raising awareness of what our history was and what it is today and what it then therefore can become and grow into tomorrow. If you want to know a future direction, you first look at the past to identify what has happened and the direction that has been taken before. None of us want to reinvent wheels. And Landmark Society has taken a huge step in wanting to do this because LGBT history has not been included in New York State history. It has not been included in the contributions that this community has made across the board. You talk about economic development. When Lieutenant Governor Duffy asked Tim Tompkins, who was an entrepreneur in the gay community and in the Rochester community, but who was also gay, to head his economic development team, that was not by mistake. That was deliberate. And so there are many other people similar who have contributed to that history and to the history of New York State. And they need to be recognized, but the places in which those organizations, those people gathered, those activities and actions occurred need to be brought to the awareness of not only Rochesterians, but to everyone who lives in New York State and the country, because it's a ripple effect. It will spread.
Well, Evelyn's list that I'm looking at here, Ryan, I just want to say to the caller, Ryan, I mean, I think the sentiment is on the money here that the struggle for LGBTQ Americans didn't start and end with Stonewall, and that's not the only. And I know he's not saying that. I think he's just simply saying, you know, just make sure you don't lose sight of the fact that LGBTQ people have been around since people have been around, and it didn't start in 1969. And Ryan, it is an important point. I am struck looking down this list that I'm holding here of places in Western New York of cultural and historic significance to the LGBTQ community here, that these so many things did start to change after Stonewall. That if you doubted whether Stonewall was just one event or one series of five nights in one place in Manhattan, so much was happening. 1970, 1970, 1970, 1971, 72, 73, down this list. So you can just feel Stonewall in this list, I think is what I'm saying. What I want to ask then, we mentioned Jim's Bar. Jim's Bar is across from Washington Square. It's where Bausch & Lomb is today, right? So that's where Jim's Bar was. Dick's 43 on Front Street. You mentioned before urban renewal. And Dick's 43 burned, is that right, Evelyn?
It burned down after it was relocated, and I can't remember where it was relocated.
What would you find on the site of where the 1970 bar was? And again, it was an early gay bar, well-known and frequented, Dick's 43. What's the site there now?
It isn't. I think it's a street. Urban renewal came mm-hmm. in. I have no idea.
Okay.
I know where Front Street was.
Yeah.
But it doesn't exist on the city map.
Okay.
Any longer, except for a very small section.
All right. Ma Martin's, you mentioned, which was a gay-friendly restaurant and a gay bar at night. Front Street, again, what's there now?
I'm sorry?
What's that, Ma Martin's now?
It was on Front Street, so that's in the same situation
as Dick's 43. Situation, yeah.
And that brings up another important point. As we age, as the city ages, things change. And people, places get torn down and rebuilt, or people die who have this history and who have lived it.
And so, Larry, this to me dovetails very closely with what we've talked about with the Landmark Society in recent years on this program, which is you can't always save every building. Mm-hmm. You can't stand in front of every bulldozer, much as a lot of us would like to. But sometimes you can save a building and the use changes, but you've got to find a way, if you can, to honor the history within that. And can you tell me a little bit about what your thoughts are when you hear, boy, somewhere on Front Street, we're not even sure where, Ma Martin's, Dick's 43, that's a really amazing thing to find out one generation later, it's sort of just gone. What can be done when something is essentially gone?
I think we can have informational markers. Mm-hmm. I think we can put it on a map, sort of where it was and sort of where it is now. One of the listings that I just love is where the first organizational meeting for AIDS Rochester was, which is now Trillium, and it's Sue Cowell's front porch. I think some place like that is a place that really rings true to so many people who were on that front porch and started that organization. So I think there has to be a way to call it out, and we may be able to put something online. We may be able to do some sort of marker or a map. I think there are going to be different ways, and I think it's going to be the mission of this group as it moves forward, the way we want to get this information out. So I do want to ask Ryan to come to the meeting and other listeners Tuesday, the
16th,
2 weeks from today, 5:30, the Landmark Society, 133 South Fitzhugh Street in Cornhill. That's where our headquarters are. It's on our website, www.landmarksociety.org. Under the calendar, we're going to be having other postings on the website. We'll be doing a Facebook page for it. So just keep checking us out.
All right, let me get back to the phones. In Greece, this is Tom. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I was wondering, I think this should be on the list, I suppose, or I was wondering if it was. There was a place on Stone Street. I don't know what it was called. It was a bar. It was maybe called something like, there was a woman who ran it, Martha Grudadaria, and it was beginning of the 1940s, maybe through the early 70s. It was there on Stone Street, and she was pretty domineering. She told the men when they could dance and everything like this, and she wouldn't let the newspaper in there, the empty closet. So they decided to go to start their own place, the Bachelor Forum, which was originally on Main and Goodman. But I've heard of Stone Street as being a gathering place for, gay men. So I'm wondering if that was on the list, if anybody has anything to say about it, and I'll get off the air now.
Thanks, Tom. Go ahead, Evelyn.
Dick's, which was also known as Martha's, began at 14 Front Street, then moved to 43 Stone Street, mm-hmm. and then actually there was a fire on, the fire was on Stone Street, and then it resurrected itself out of the ashes and moved to State Street. So, yes, it is on the list. The Bachelor Forum is on the list. And actually, the Bachelor Forum today is the oldest existing identified LGBT bar in the city. The Avenue Pub was bought by a man who has... Certainly, it's gay-friendly, and LGBT men and women will continue to go there, but it's not identified specifically as that. And at one time, there were 14 gay bars in Rochester, and now we're down to basically one self-identified gay bar, and other bars, 140 Alex, the Avenue Pub, they're gay-friendly, and they're welcoming. But they're not specifically identified as a gay bar.
Yeah, the Bachelor Forum's owner was on this program, actually after the tragic events in Orlando, shared some amazing stories of inclusion and acceptance that have unfolded over the years and how long that's taken. And I look over at John Cullen as someone who has worked in inclusion. I mean, I like to think everybody at this table is working in inclusion, but, you know, John, I remember talking... that day and hearing a story of someone. This is someone who owns the Bachelor Forum, the oldest gay bar in Rochester, still a vibrant place, a prominent community member, but it took a long time for certain family members, people to embrace that, to be able to talk about a man and his husband. And that's another thing I think we take for granted sometimes when we say, well, marriage equality passed or the Supreme Court made this ruling or whatever. Inclusion means a lot of different things, doesn't it?
Yeah, and even though marriage equality has passed, many states still have laws that mean people can lose their jobs because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Also, they can lose housing. So even though people think, you know, we've reached this point, if someone has... a husband or same-sex partner who lives in one of those states, it's very difficult for them to get married because there is a chance that that person could lose their job, could lose their housing. So we still have a long way to go. I know the Senate and the legislature are working. The actual governor signed an executive order to prevent discrimination based on gender identity because they couldn't get it through the Senate. So they still need to look at these things, not just at a state level, but at a federal level as well, so that everyone is treated equally.
If I look down the list, because I don't have time to get through every one of them, but even, for example, Genesee Valley Park, which was the site of a gay community picnic starting in July of 1973. That's on the list of consideration. Durand Eastman Park was a location, apparently in June of 1974, of many arrests and of the members of the gay community by plainclothesmen. Is that right, Evelyn?
Mm-hmm. Yes. There were many, many sting operations.
In the park.
In the parks. And, of course... They occurred because it's illegal in public parks to be nude or not be fully clothed. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily because they were gay men and lesbians. It was because of the way they were dressed. When we, the Gay Alliance, would hear about a sting operation, we would write out a pamphlet and go to the parks and hand the pamphlets out to anyone who was in the park so that they would know that it would not be safe for them to stay there, otherwise they would be subject to arrest. And the Gay Alliance has been in the forefront of LGBT advocacy since it became the Gay Alliance in 1973, originally the Gay Liberation Front.
And interesting to see Channel 13 on the list, the December of 1982, the first time the Gay Alliance of the Genesee Valley appeared on Morning Break on Channel 13. Of course, now Scott Fearing and the many great people there are fixtures in our community, but you think about first time of visibility. Strassenburg Planetarium's on the list for a 1980 first gay night under the stars at the Strassenburg Planetarium. There you go. First Unitarian Church, probably won't surprise you to hear, in 1980 they were the first to hold a gay prom. So look at this list of Rochester landmarks and markers that the Landmark Society is helping put together, Evelyn, of course, helping put together, and they want you. We're down to 30 seconds, so Larry, last time to let the community know, 2 weeks from tonight, and then tell us what's happening 2 weeks from tonight and what you hope to do with it. You've got 35 seconds.
35 seconds. Well, 2 weeks from tonight, Tuesday, the 16th of August, 5:30 at the Landmark Society headquarters, 133 South Fitzhugh. And we just want people to get together and talk. We're going to, you know, give a little presentation, just let you know what we're up to. But we just want to get people together who are interested in this initiative. And we've come up with a little byline for the initiative, which is sharing our pride of place, which I think says a lot about Rochester and about the LGBTQ community. And I do want to call out to our partners on this. The City of Rochester has been great, and they've been involved in our steering committee, as well as Trillium Health and WXXI. And The Little are also partners, along with Out and Equal New York, Finger Lakes, and Image Out.
Yeah, Image Out had a couple of locations, a film festival and Little Theater, of course, on that list there. So we'll see what comes out of this list, and we'll talk more about this. Larry Francer from the Landmark Study. Thanks for being here,
Thank
Larry.
Thank you, Evan.
Evelyn Bailey, great work, and thank you for being here and sharing your historical knowledge as well with us. Thank you so much. And John Cullen, thank you for the history lesson on Stonewall and other matters as well. Thank you for
being
here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Rob, Megan, and the whole team at Connections. I'm Evan. Have a great afternoon.